to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. In this episode, we bring you a recording from a recent panel event titled, Are the Asia-Pacific Small States Different from Other Small States? Dr. Patrizia Tamburello and Peter Allam from the IMF presented on their recent work on small states, while Vivek Suri from the World Bank acted as discussant. The slides from the presentations are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
Well, thank you everyone for coming. It's good to have such a fine turnout, especially as we are getting to the end of the academic year. In fact, we're in the coming towards the end of the exam period. So a lot of people have wound down and headed off. So it's great that we can nevertheless manage to get such a good turnout. My name is Stephen Howes, and I'm the Director of the Development Policy Centre here at the Crawford School, and I'm your host for today's event. And let me begin by acknowledging the first Australians on whose land we meet today, and in particular, let's pay our respects to the Ngunnawal people and their elders past and present. Now, normally we just have an hour for these lunchtime seminars, and we used to give you sandwiches, but these are times of austerity, so we don't have any more sandwiches, and it's a big event. We thought a lot of content, and we wanted to have some discussion, so we've given an hour and a half. So I hope you brought your sandwiches like me. There is tea and coffee. That's all we can give you, I'm afraid. So you're not coming for the food. But you're coming to hear from the IMF and the World Bank about Pacific Island region. And of course, that's a very important region for Australia, and it's a core, or the core region for our centre in terms of our economic and development work. We have two speakers here from the IMF, Patrizia Tamburello and Peter Allam. So thank you both for coming. I'll just say Patrizia is the head of the Pacific Division in the IMF. And Peter is from a central unit and head of, he was telling me, for all the fragile states and small states, and difficult states. So he has a central corporate interest, and it's an indication that these kind of units exist, both regional and thematic, of the growing importance of the Pacific region and of small states sort of on the global development agenda. The IMF has started organising a regular conference series in the Pacific, and the second one of those is happening at the end of the week in Vanuatu. And so Patrizia, who's the organiser of the conference, is on her way through. And for those of you who came to hear Jim Adams' talk last week, which will shortly be up on our web, in fact, he specifically singled out Patrizia, and maybe that's why there's so many people here. But he said, we should definitely come and hear what you have to say, and he acknowledged the work you've been doing for the Pacific. So the IMF have recently put out a report, Are the Asia and Pacific Small States Different from Other Small States? And that's what Patrizia and Peter will be talking to. And then we've asked Vivek. Vivek is the lead economist from the World Bank for the Pacific Island region, based in Sydney. This is his second stint, so I think altogether you've had, 6 years or more working on the Pacific. And some of you will have been here last year, it's quite a while ago now, but we helped launch the World Bank report on Pacific futures, and we thought that was a very important report as well, so we thought it'd be good to get these two different perspectives. So Vivek will give some comments, and then we'll open it up for discussion. But Patrizia's mentioned, if you've got comments or questions as you go, please just raise your hand. Just a couple of announcements. I did, the IMF staff have indicated an interest in meeting anyone who wants to, it might be interested in having a career at the IMF. So I'm pleased to tell you some of our best master students are here. And so stay back afterwards and just talk to them if you're interested in that as a possible career opportunity. And although it is the end of the year, we do have a number of events coming up. And I just want to say, in particular, we've got an event tomorrow. We wouldn't normally have two events back to back, but there's a crisis in Syria, and it just so happens that the UNICEF representative from Lebanon is in Australia. And so if you want to get a first-hand view of the crisis in Syria and how it's affecting the region, that's tomorrow at 3:30. And we've got another couple of events before the year is out, and you can find the details out the front. All right, but that's enough from me, so I'm going to hand it over to the IMF.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Patricia and I are going to be playing sort of a sort of team tag, as it were. I'm going to kick things off with a very brief introduction on small states and the IMF. Patricia is going to take you through some work that she and her team have been doing ahead of the Friday's conference in Vanuatu. And they're also putting a book together, which should come out next spring, on Pacific Island small states issues. Yeah, it's a work in progress, but a lot of the analytical work she's going to present in some of her slides. Her slides are fairly heavy on sort of informational content, so you may want to ask questions as she makes her presentation, rather than leave it to the end, by which time the forgotten one is there. So. That's the order. I'm going to just kick off with small states and the IMF. Patricia's going to go on and talk about challenges and risks. I'm going to end up with some broad policy messages at the end. As you all know, the IMF is a global institution. We've got 200 odd members, a bit less than that. Of those, 42 we would define as small states. Typical definition of small state is a country with a population of less than 1.5 million. But for our developmental work, we tend to focus on the sort of non-advanced economy, non-rich oil exporting countries, and so there's 33 of those left, including the Pacific Island states. And out of that 33, we also segment the 15 what we call micro states with populations of less than 200,000, and that again is an arbitrary number, but you know, very small populations bring their own developmental challenges. Globally, there are three broad groups, or two consolidated groups, and then a miscellaneous category. The Caribbean has about a third of our small states, the Pacific Islands another third, and then there's a sort of miscellaneous category spread. There's one in Europe, a couple in the Middle East, a couple in Africa, including Comoros. As a UN organization, the IMF has been working on issues of the developmental challenges of small states for more than a couple of decades. The UN itself launched a Barbados program of action nearly two decades ago on small states, and there's been a series of initiatives and programs under the UN auspices since then. One of the sort of major analytical works was this 2000 World Bank Commonwealth Secretariat study, which we've used as a sort of a launching pad for some of our thinking. Recognizing that we're now two decades into sort of UN concern about small states, and the situation hasn't improved, and in many respects is getting worse, yeah, as illustrated by the. We launched a big work program this year. We prepared three papers for our executive board in March. These are all available on the IMF website. There's a sort of umbrella paper looking at macroeconomic issues in small states, and then there's two companion supplement papers, one on the Caribbean and one on the Pacific Islands. Patricia and her team authored the Pacific Islands study. The small states in the fund, we don't have a separate set of policies or institutional framework for small states. They're eligible to borrow from us just in the same way as any other country is. We also have policy consultations with them on an annual basis or biannual basis in the cases of some countries. We provide training, technical assistance, either from our headquarters. Thanks, Dean. And for small states, they also appreciate their membership of the IMF because we provide a global forum for them. We have spring and annual meetings where we bring together all of the central bank governors, ministers of finance, and I think for many small states, that's an excellent opportunity for them to liaise with their counterparts in larger countries. On the TA side, we have regional technical assistance centres. Many of you have heard of the centre in Suva, which covers the Pacific region. We've also got one covering the Caribbean region. The Pacific one was launched nearly two decades ago. Right, so let me pass on there to Patricia, who will take you through some of her work that she's been doing on the islands.
Thank you. Thank you very much to all for being here, especially under the exam sessions. So the title of the presentation is, are the Pacific, the Asian Pacific small states different from the other small states? And the answer is yes. So all the presentation that I'm going to give will sort of highlight the differences and why the Pacific Islands face more challenges and vulnerability relative to the other small states. So this is a little bit of the outline. The first part is about what are the risks and what are the challenges of the Pacific Islands, and everything that's going to run after this concept of volatility. This is the major challenge that they face. They face volatility in terms of their growth, they face volatility in terms of their aid, revenues, and so the big policy question is how do they manage, what's the best way to manage this volatility? How can they have macro framework so that this volatility is minimized. Just to give you a little bit of a landscape, so these are, as you know, very small states, and relative to the other small states in other regions are further out, and they're pretty much scattered. Now, what is interesting about that is they're not only they're further out, but they're scattered, but this idea of distance have changed over time, because you can be closer or further from markets depending on how connected you are. So it's not really geography that matters, it's connectivity that matters. And this is, we think it's a good message, because it's a way to say to countries, your policy matters. It's not, you're not just constrained, but what your geography is telling you. But you can see from the chart that Tuvalu and Palau and Marshall Islands, these are really the smallest members of the IMF and the smallest in the world. This chart says that financial deepening is not very high, and it's actually is lower than other small states. And you know that access to credit by the private sector is really important for inclusive growth. So this is a challenge that these countries have compared to the other ones. And in fact, this chart on private credit Gini coefficient basically says that, and this is really more of a regression than a chart, so it's not really raw data. It says that credit is very, access to credit is very important to decrease inequality. The other message is more on the landscape, more than in the analysis itself, but business environment is also quite weak in the Pacific Islands compared to some other small states, although there's been a lot of progress in recent years. But this is another challenge in terms of their growth development. And then here's sort of the core of the presentation, which is really managing these shocks, vulnerability, and volatility. So the Pacific Islands are subject to a lot of shocks. So some of these shocks are exogenous, like they have natural disasters, and this, they're very similar to the Caribbean islands. They face also terms of trade shocks. These are countries that have very narrow production and export bases. So if they are net commodity importers, of course they are subject to the volatility of the food and commodity prices that we have seen during the crisis in 2008-2009, but also if they are commodity producers. So terms of trade shocks is a big deal for the Pacific Islands, and also political shocks. There's a lot of turnover in terms of governments, and this also has an impact in designing policies. They are very reliant on aid. There are some economies that, like Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, so that have more than 40% of GDP in aid. So compared to other countries in the world, this is quite a challenge in terms of growth. The question is, can they ever grow out of aid? It is a big question, and we'll discuss this later. And this chart shows what I was talking about early on. So if you see the white line is the export and the other one is the imports, and shows how small export of goods and services are compared to their import balance, which means that basically unless they receive grants, they're going to run very large current account deficits. And this deficit needs to be financed somehow. And if there's a question, does anybody has a question? No, you're done. Okay, another big challenge, and this is a little bit of a counterpart of the current account deficit, is the large fiscal deficit. The private sector does not play a big role, so really, from a national account point of view, is the government that is running these current account deficits. And so if we remove the grants, you see that the current the line of the Pacific, and especially the microstates, is the one really below, which means that some of these countries are running fiscal deficit for 30% of GDP, which is an enormous number compared to all the other countries. We put there the small states and the Caribbean islands, and so it's quite remarkable. And this other chart shows that perhaps, you know, one of the questions is what is the right fiscal balance to use to assess fiscal policy in the Pacific Islands. And some of them are commodity producers, and some are very reliant on fish's license fees. So again, here we show what would be that balance without these resources, and it's very volatile. So the volatility plays a big role and complicates policy making. So this is another chart that basically says that the Pacific Islands, compared to all the other states, all the other groupings, really have a higher fiscal deficit. It is quite impressive. Now, GDP per capita, GDP growth has also been very volatile, and look again, what are the other groups? The small states, the non-small states, and the micro states, or the states that, as Peter was defining earlier, are the one with less than 200,000 people, are the one that face more volatility. This is the chart on the left, and here we put some information there, and then later on I can go back if you want, but it's really, what's the role of governance? I mean, does governance play a role also in explaining this volatility or not? And it's what I was talking about early on about changing governments, but there is also sort of more of a corruption issue, and we take this index from the World Bank. So if we look at the fiscal framework, as some analysis we're going to present later in Vanuatu, and the reason why we're looking at fiscal is that some of the Pacific Islands do not have a central bank, so really fiscal policy matters a lot, and also structural reforms. If we look at these slides, again, volatility is very high for the Pacific Islands compared to relative to all the other groupings, and in particular the microstates. And also the volatility of remittances is very important. And this relates to the fact that, you know, it's a globalized economy, and basically they are subject to the business cycle, you know, of the region, and also the global business cycle. So there's
been... How do you define volatility?
This is about standard deviation. It's up to standard deviation from the mean. But we have different measures. We use it different measures to test the robustness. Again, this is an important chart, it's the volatility of grants, and this reflects the fact that there were traditional development partners, like for example the UK in the early 90s, and now they're less engaged, but you have new development partners like the EU. But it also reflects the fact that a lot of aid is earmarked for projects, and therefore, you know, build a road or a bridge every year, but still there is quite a volatility in terms of grants. And this chart here again shows that aid matters for the Pacific Islands more than for every other group. So the other characteristic, which I think it's quite important to say, is that the current spending is very large in the Pacific Islands, and this is related with the cost of government. So not only they are small, but they're very scattered. Therefore, every service has to be provided, of course, hospitals, schools, and administration in every single island. We have constructed an index of dispersion based on how many people live in each island. It was kind of very time consuming. But it shows that basically Micronesia is the most dispersed country in the world, and then Kiribati, Marshall Islands. And then we compare this with the Caribbean countries. And it is quite striking. Now, one of the countries that is less dispersed in the Pacific is actually Palau. Palau is not dispersed, and I mean, perhaps this is one of the reasons why it's doing a little better, but these charts basically put together, you know, if you see Tuvalu is the smallest, and then is also the one that has the highest current government spending. Because they're scattered, and the government has to provide a lot of services, it's also the largest employers in the Pacific Islands, and this is one of the reasons. This is introduced a rigidity in the budget, of course, because it's very hard to cut salaries and wages. So spending rigidity is quite a remarkable feature. And this is the spending part of the budget. So you have a current expenditure and capital expenditure. And this capital expenditure has also been volatile, in part reflecting the volatility of aid that I was talking about earlier. So the capital expenditure, more than anything else, is financed through donors' funds. So this is the country part. This slide shows again that the microstates are the most fragile state. In fact, under our classification, even the IMF classification, Peter was talking about earlier about fragile state, but Kiribati and Marshall Islands, Micronesia are all fragile state, and they also appear in these charts. So they have higher volatility than the others. And so why is this a problem? Why to have volatility is a problem? Because what would be optimal from a policy-making point of view would be for government to support the economy in bad times and sort of cooling down the economy when there is overheating. But in the Pacific Island, this is a big challenge, because what governments end up doing is they spend more when they have more revenues, which means when the economy goes well, and they spend less when they have less revenue, which is when the economy doesn't do well, so they should be doing the opposite. Because it's very hard to handle this volatility. And so policy, what we say is that policy becomes pro-cyclical, okay? They amplify the business cycle, and this is what we don't want. We would like policy to smooth this business cycle, so to have sort of more constant path of consumption through the cycle. So I guess one of the question we have with the authorities that they ask us, how can we do that? I mean, what's your advice? And we're working together with them. I mean, this is a joint work. This is another way to show procyclicality. So basically, this chart shows if policy, fiscal policy were not procyclical, these two bars, the gray and the blue, would be sort of the same level. But basically, this one shows that when the economy is overheating, the government is spending more, and the other way around. So it's another dimension, but it's the same concept. Okay, so this chart shows that the Pacific Islands do not face the same challenges of the Caribbean states in terms of debt. Okay. So managing that is part of the macroeconomic policy thing, but this debt has been increasing over time for some of the islands, and in particular Samoa and Tonga. And so the question is how to avoid getting into the debt overhang, like the Caribbean. We've learned through the Caribbean, but also what is happening in other countries, in other regions, that once you are in that negative, you know, path, it's really hard to restore growth, because you need to generate extra revenues. You need to have a lot of your resources are going to pay the debt, while in fact they should go toward development needs. So we have to be careful that the Pacific Islands don't get into the same loop. And as I was saying, one of the dilemma of the governments, and so when we talk to them and we say, you know, you really have to be careful, you need to save for rainy days, and you have to you need to make sure you sort of smooth the business cycle, the answer we get is that it's very hard to find the right balance between saving, which in the IMF jargon we say calling buffers, and on the other hand, spending. Okay, so this analysis that we have done shows basically that this trade-off between building buffers, which means having low debt, having lower fiscal deficit, and at the same time spending, it does not occur to the extent that spending is tilted toward capital spending. So this is quite striking in both charts, where you can see that growth of, I don't know how to use this, I'm concerned I'm going to have the same problem early on, but you see on the second bar, the high capital, high buffer. So this, it means that countries that have allocated their expenditure envelope more toward capital end up having a higher GDP per capita growth and also lower debt. This is, as I said, real GDP per capita, so it's quite amazing the difference with the other groups. And then we can distribute the presentation, and I don't want to go further on this because it's still a work in progress. Now, the other slides shows that countries that has allocated more on capital spending were able to grow more and having lower debt, but it's more of it's a static analysis. That's not taking into account the fact that what matters, especially for the Pacific Islands, is not really the debt, the face value of the debt, but it's more what we call the net present value of the debt. And this is because most of the debt is what we call concessional. So the interest rate at which is contracted, it's not the market interest rate, but it's a lower interest rate. So what matters is really what is the net present value of that debt. And we do with the World Bank together, we run the debt sustainability analysis with the country's authorities. And so we computed a measure of what we call the fiscal space. So when minister says, when is enough to build buffers? When can I start, you know, investing a little bit more? So this is a way to sort of answering to that question. I mean, we have different methodology that would answer to that question. It's $10 million question. But, you know, we started this discussion with them. What does it mean to define fiscal space in the Pacific Islands? So this is one way to do it. I'm just going to present some different ideas here. This is another way to do it. I mean, it looks like a strange chart, but basically this is a methodology that was developed by the IMF three years ago. It was not done for the Pacific Islands. It was done for advanced economies. It's Jonathan Austries that's the main author, and it's called the Fiscal Space. We revised the model and trying to adapt to the Pacific Islands. I will tell you in a moment why this methodology are important. But basically, the intuition behind this is that markets, which for the Pacific Islands is more a better proxy by investors, care about the history of the country. So was the country in the past able to repay its debt or not? You know, the debt sustainability analysis does not have that feature. The debt sustainability analysis said that to the extent that you can have future primary balance surpluses, you're going to be able to repay the debt. But is this credible or not? Because sometimes we put numbers that look good, but perhaps they're not. Some of the results are not attainable. So we try to complement that analysis with this one. And then the third one is just estimating, another way to estimate the fiscal cost of buffers. So basically the opportunity cost of having low debt or having lower fiscal deficit is basically the foregone expenditure, what you're not going to spend because you want to build the buffers. And so the opportunity cost of that spending can be estimated somehow or can be computed, let me put it that way. And we did this for every single Pacific Island countries. It's based on a Cobb-Douglas function. So it's sort of very standard, but it was the first time that has been done. So we thought we want to share this very preliminary result with you. And we compare the same methodology we've done for advanced and emerging markets in LIC and low-income countries, and they're very much consistent with Francesco Caselli and other economists that work on this type of work in the past. Now, as I said, fiscal space and building buffers and investing is important to the extent that it really can improve, you know, the living standards. And one way to see that is looking at the Human Development Index. Again, this is something that we take from the World Bank. But what we thought was interesting to see was what is the relationship between how much space countries have in terms of to invest, and where do they stand in terms of Human Development Index. And what is, I think, quite remarkable is that this three methodologies shows more or less, I mean, of course, they're not totally equivalent, but that the countries like, for example, Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea and you know, the ordering is quite similar, that have still fiscal space, are also on the lower end of the Human Development Index, so they still have some space to go in terms of investment. Of course, the message here is not to go out and start investing without taking into account the other constraints, because what has happened in the Pacific Islands is that, in fact, there's been quite a bit of an allocation of spending on health and education, but what matters is that they did not achieve the same outcome as other small states that perhaps invest the same or even less. So here there is a notion which is the quality of spending. I mean, what is the rate of return of this aid, of this investment? And this is not covered by this analysis, but definitely it's something that it is very important for development partners to look at. And this is the last couple of charts that basically say that countries should use this fiscal space quite wisely, and we had this event analysis. So we look at some episodes of spending and how was the spending financed or allocated, whether it was capital or whether it was current. And we can see that during these episodes, the Pacific Islands allocated 35% of their spending envelope toward capital spending, while the emerging and developing economies only to 24. So there is an effort, really, to, which is very good, to allocate more toward capital spending. That, what does it mean? To build bridge, to build human capital and improve health. And this chart, which again is the result of this event analysis, shows that countries that have, during episode of expansion, used capital spending as opposed to non-capital spending, were able to achieve higher growth rates and also lower debt. Now the last part is this one, and is that the recent business cycle, which is the first chart, shows that the Pacific Islands also follow a V shape like the other countries in the world during the global recession. To a certain extent, they did better than some comparators like the Caribbean. One of the reasons we think is because they're linked in terms of business cycle to Australia and emerging Asia, and of course these countries were doing better than the US where the crisis was. But nevertheless, from a structural point of view, from a long-term point of view, they seem to be stuck on a low growth path. And this conference that we're organizing in Villa in Vanuatu on Friday tries to bring together all policymakers and discuss this issue about growth. So it's more the long-term, what we call potential growth. And the result of the analysis that we've done shows that, in fact, there's been lower education, lower trade openness, and lower initial income, higher GDP, and higher... These are all, you know, negative factors for growth. And then great remoteness, and we put in lower connectivity because, as we said, it's not really the distance that matters, but it's the lining shipping index. I mean, how costly is to access and how... You know, cost is for them to be linked to the rest of the region, and all these factors explain their underperformance. So these are some policy messages, and the policy messages are that policy matters. So it's not all about geography. They can improve their macro framework by having fiscal frameworks. Where they set up some funds or, you know, for rainy days and sort of smooth their volatility. They need to sort of find revenues, more revenues, because some of the revenues is coming down. For example, the one that is related to import tariff is coming down. They need to improve the composition of public spending so that the government can crowd in the private sector. And they need to strengthen institution, improve governance, and where, to the extent possible, they should also, you know, operate at the regional. They should have some regional solutions, given that they share some common problems. And one of, for example, the Nauru agreement and the new scheme on vessels, we think it has been quite successful on that. We're not expert. Of this, and that's why we're allowing the World Bank for this issue. So I will stop here. I'll give it back to Peter.
Thanks, Patricia. What I'd like to do is finish up with some very high-level observations on the small states. I mean, one question is, why is it that some states are very poor with per capita incomes of $1,000, say, and other small states managed to make it into the advanced economy grouping, San Marino, Malta, etc. And people who've studied the performance of small states, like Bergoglio in Malta, have identified four factors. This is not advanced econometrics, but sort of case study-based evidence, but it seems to be fairly convincing. You've got macro stability and market efficiency, good government, social development. And those of you who are familiar with the sort of Washington consensus view on what supports development globally, I think this is a fairly familiar set of observations. So for macro stability, I mean, I'd like to go through each of those four elements and sort of discuss it in a small states context. Very briefly, okay. So what does macro stability mean for small states? It's very difficult to identify a small state which is macro stable on a sustainable basis. They just tend to be subject to such large shocks that it's more a question of when you observe a shock, how successful are they in restoring stability afterwards? I'm contrasting here the Caribbean countries which have accumulated high debt levels, and I think that's an example of countries which are not macro stable. Seychelles has gone through a series of shocks, and in 2008 it was a balance payments crisis. The fund came in and they adopted a fairly effective adjustment program. So I think you could hold up Seychelles as a country which demonstrated more resilience in a macro stable context. Market efficiency. Market efficiency in a small state context is almost a contradiction in terms. When you've got a very small market, it's very difficult to make that efficient. Small markets tend to discourage investors, and in that environment, the government's challenge is how do I encourage investment and job creation? And the governments that do it wrong tend to focus on tax exemptions, which undermine their tax base. And they encourage incentives for investors to then look for new tax incentives, higher tax incentives, as a way to improve their corporate results rather than looking for efficiency-based solutions. The Caribbean is a case where you've got widespread tax exemptions. The other case where governments get it wrong is by trying to substitute for the private sector by setting up state-owned enterprises to do the investment and job creation. And their state-owned enterprises then become try to control the market. They discourage new entry. Singapore is a case where they've got it right in the right from the beginning, or relatively early on in their development process. They focused really on ensuring that the supply side was pro-business, and that's a case where you've got a small state which leapfrogged from very low levels of development to an advanced economy within one generation. Good governance. What does that mean? I think for many small states, you could argue that governance works relatively well if you've got a small population, and particularly where it's a homogenous population and in one relatively small area, it's relatively easy to do governance. But there is the risk of cronyism. You know, where you've got a large investor in a small country, it's natural for that investor to have a very close relationship with the government and to look for favours from the government. You have this cronyism come up. One way of controlling that is to have the economy open to foreign competition so that the large investors are competing with foreigners. Good governance, you know, there's a classic example of Haiti and Dominican Republic, which just shows how important economic institutions and legal institutions are for economic development. These are two countries which share one island in the Caribbean, very similar populations, very similar natural resource bases, but one's got a GDP per capita 8 times higher than the other, and it essentially comes down to the fact that they've got different economic institutions in the Dominican Republic. And on a small, those are not small states, but if you take Djibouti, small state, it's in the 14th percentile for government effectiveness, contrasted to St. Kitts and Nevis, which has an even smaller population but is in the 76th percentile for government effectiveness. And the difference between those two, if you just look at the way that the legal system and the police system handles foreign investors, they both have laws which are in principle even-handed between foreign and domestic investors. But in Djibouti's case, the legal system is basically set up to protect the Djiboutians. So if you're a foreign company investing in Djibouti and you have a conflict with a domestic investor, you'll find a lot of pressure within the system, to within the legal system, to come out with a solution that favours the Djibouti population. Social development, the last of the four observations. It's very difficult in a small state to get economic development unless you have social development. Singapore's a classic case. When they had independence in 65, education was basically only available for the affluent. You had a population which was largely uneducated, illiterate. On independence, they adopted universal primary education. Within a decade, universal secondary education. And within a generation, they were global leaders in maths and sciences, and they're continuing to press forwards on education now, trying to promote innovation within the educational system. Completely opposite, Comoros. A decade later in independence, but still in the bottom 25% in global literacy, and because of that low education level, they find it very difficult to move up the ladder in terms of economic development. A last couple of observations, looking across small states, what is it that sort of marks out the countries that do well, apart from those four factors? The countries that do well, like Singapore, Mauritius, St. Kitts, etc., clearly put economic development at the heart of public policy making. And for each of those countries, you'll find an economic development agency which is focused on improving the supply side, improving the economy, relatively influential in the government apparatus, has an influence close to the decision makers, etc. And the other factor, I think, is that when you look at development for some of these countries, they don't get it right from the beginning, and it's a process of sort of moving from one stage of development to the next. So in the case of Mauritius, they started off with sugar, benefiting from trade preferences. They moved on to textiles. When those trade preferences disappeared, textiles was the next phase of development. Those trade preferences disappeared. They moved now on to tourism and services. So you need a degree of flexibility, ability to sort of roll with the punches. Singapore, again, they started out with a low level of education in the textile and electronic assembly area, moved on to precision and engineering semiconductors when they had higher, more foreign direct investment and better skilled people, and the latest stage is sort of world-class business and financial services. So a couple of observations there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of information. As someone who likes graphs myself, I'm impressed. I'm going to move to having two graphs per slide. So, but now I'll call on Vivek, who's going to give us some comments on what we've just heard.
So thanks. Thanks very much, Stephen. It's great to be back at the ANU, especially at the Development Policy Center. I think the work that the center is doing on the Pacific is simply superb. I mean, I'm a regular user of your blog, which I find very, very informative. So it's great to have the opportunity to speak here and at the Crawford School. So, much that's been said already by Peter and Patrizia, I mean, I do agree with a lot of it. But if I agreed with them, then Stephen wouldn't have me here and it would be all very boring. So I'll not go over the areas that I probably agree with, but I'll try and sort of find out, talk about some areas where we might view things a little differently. And when I say we, you know, this is not the World Bank or its executive director's views. It is my view. Otherwise, I'd lose my job probably. So with that, I mean, I think the first thing that I think Patricia said was that, and Peter said was that, yeah, the two sets of small states are different, and I think this chart kind of shows it. And that difference is determined by geography. Connectivity is a second-order issue, is a second problem. Sorry, not second, it's a second problem. But first, you know, geography is a determining factor that differentiates the Pacific and the Caribbean. Caribbean closer together. That difference on the chart seems small, but that's almost 2,000 kilometers of GDP-weighted. So the question then is, you know, if geography is the determining factor that separates these two sets of countries, what are some of the policy messages that we can derive in terms of development in these countries, especially the Pacific? That's going to be the focus. Okay, so the one thing is that the Pacific is different. By the way, you know, I hadn't seen this presentation before, so I just kind of put together a few slides which I thought I could use in answering these. So if these seem a bit sort of haphazard, I apologize for that. But anyway, the point I wanted to make was that, you know, we like to call the Pacific because all the countries are in the Pacific. But actually, they are very different. And the region is only perhaps a region in the minds of development agencies. And this is something that was there in the presentation that was just given, that these countries are quite different from each other and quite different from the Caribbean. So we have those which are, dependent on natural resources, those which are dependent on tourism and remittances, and these ones which are especially different and special in the Pacific are the ones where growth is driven by the public sector. So this is not responding to a cycle. This is almost a permanence of the public sector in these countries. And therefore, these are different. I mean, I see Ron there in the audience. Many, many years ago, Ron told me that, you know, it's not that the public sectors are too large, that the private sectors are too small. And I think, that simple sentence actually has a lot in it. And I think, the real challenge is how do you make the private sectors large in these countries here? I'll skip this, but this is basically, you know, an old slide that shows that how basically remoteness increases the costs of production in small countries and why they're going to be different from neighborhoods. One other point I wanted to make, and this is within the sort of world of small countries, where remoteness and geography is associated with lower incomes. So countries that are more remote, howsoever defined, and you know, this is defined on the basis of simply distance to a measure of average distance to market. So you find that, you know, per capita incomes are lower in countries that are more remote. So to me, it is about geography, and what can be done about geography is really the question. And I also wanted to give you a slightly different way to look at volatility and say that volatility is actually a reflection of geography. When countries get so remote and so small, you find that they cannot specialize they get very, very specialized and not broad-based. That itself causes volatility, and you see the same in landlocked states in Africa. So for many of our countries, remoteness leads to volatility. Of course, that's not the case in the countries like Papua New Guinea or in Timor-Leste, where the volatility does come from terms of trade shocks, as Patricia showed. Okay, so as Stephen said, there's many, many elements in there in the presentation. So a little difficult which ones to pick out in these 10 minutes. So let me just sort of make a few statements and maybe leave it open for questions later on. So one is, why do we focus on growth in the Pacific? What we are concerned about is increasing living standards of the population. How do you increase living standards of the populations? Well, one way is to deliver good public services, modern public services. What do I mean by that? Good health, good education, good telecommunications, power, electricity. So the focus of policy in the Pacific should be on delivering better public services. And maybe growth would be a collateral benefit of delivering better public services, as it has been in some cases. But the question, of course, is how do you finance those public services? Now, typically in your large countries, high-income countries, public services are delivered through taxation. Taxation which is typically linked to a growing private sector. Now, we can get into this debate, but I think we have to... geography limits the extent to which the private sector will grow in most of our Pacific countries. What that means is that the governments are unlikely to have the level of revenues needed to deliver those modern public services, meaning they have to be funded by someone. And I think that is the role for external assistance. Now, I'm not calling it aid, or rather even external assistance, because there have been many sort of interpretations of the aid that the Pacific gets. It is a payment for a service, of a geopolitical service. Whatever it is, there is some kind of external flow, unrequited external flow, that is needed to deliver modern public services to the population, and that should be the target of development policy in the Pacific. So it's not really, growing out of aid. It is better utilization, more effective aid. That should be the target of policy. And I could quickly link that to, the issue that was raised by Peter right in the end, which is about governance. And, effective aid is about effective governance. So delivering better public services requires better governance. But that term, as many of you work in the Pacific know, governance is a very difficult concept in the Pacific. When I use the term modern public services, I was defining a certain kind of public service, which we all, health, education, telecoms. Now, to deliver those public services, modern services, you need modern forms of organization. Now, and that's the challenge, because it's a political challenge. It's a challenge of overlaying these modern systems of organization with the traditional systems of governance that exist in the Pacific. I don't have an answer to that, but this is really a question which we struggle with. How do you make these modern sort of governance systems better fit with the traditional systems of governance in the Pacific? So that's the policy challenge over there. What is good governance and how do we get it in the Pacific? That's just a chart to show, this link between remoteness and geography that I guess this is a chart many times used now, but it really shows that growth happens through agglomerations and market access. If you do not have agglomeration, you do not have growth. And this was the focus of the World Development Report of 2009 from the World Bank, and I think applies very well in the Pacific. The reason for showing this picture is actually a slightly different one, I think, which is that both Patrizia and Peter mentioned, the role of improving the business environment. Okay. But actually, there's some work, and very, very recent work, that shows actually, you know, the best business environment isn't going to do anything if you don't have agglomerations. Agglomerations are sort of, if you do not have agglomerated economic activity, improving the business environment will not give you a kick in terms of growth of the private sector or firm growth. So if you have that, then a good business environment works better. Good business environment is a necessary but not sufficient condition for growth. So again, you have to think differently about the Pacific.
Two minutes.
Okay, let me quickly jump to one thing which I think both Patricia and Peter said about in terms of fiscal policy. So what is good fiscal policy? Good fiscal policy is actually saving in good times and spending in bad. And we have an example from the Pacific, Tuvalu. No one would expect it, but it is. The Tuvalu Trust Fund, when it was higher than its I'm not sure if people are familiar with the Tuvalu Trust Fund, but it is a fund, as you can call it, a mini sovereign wealth fund that was built from donor receipts many years ago, and the returns of those donor receipts are supposed to finance, was supposed to provide budgetary self-reliance. Of course, that's not happened, and that's part of the issue in the Pacific. But what Tuvalu did was, in the good years, when its trust fund value was high, it saved. It saved in what is called a consolidated investment fund. So it built up its buffer. But then it got hit by a large shock. And that large shock lasted 4 years. Okay? And that buffer, on its own, would have gone to zero had it not been, even a country that followed this save in good times, spend in bad, it was additional donor contributions that continued to be needed for Tuvalu to finance its budget deficit. So why is this example important? This example is important that, you know, how do you define good times in the Pacific? You know, these are not countries where you have the sort of the business cycles that you see in advanced market economies, where, you know, upswing typically linked to animal spirits or whatever you have, you know, lead to a boom and, you know, government revenues rise, and so governments should save them or run down their debt so they can spend in bad times. So what I'm getting at is you need a concept of a surplus. You know, you save when you have a surplus, or you know, and I think Patricia, I think, has some very interesting charts using a slightly different concept, using the debt concept in terms of defining a fiscal buffer. So, okay, the point is that you need the concept of a surplus where which you can save. Should that surplus include aid receipts or should exclude aid receipts? Why is that important? Because currently in the Pacific, and not all countries are alike, when there is a downturn, you have aid money serving as the potentially serving as the counter-cyclical flow that smooths out expenditure. But that aid money was also available in good times. So what are you saving? Are you saving and spending aid money, or is it that, you know, there is a constant flow of external assistance? You're not growing out of aid. There is a constant and predictable and flexible aid flow that is needed over the long term. And this concept of surplus needs to be defined over and above that. And really, that's a question for you guys. You know, how do you define a surplus in countries that are so dependent on donor flows? I guess I'm running out of time. I could go on, but I should stop there. But just one... there was one final point. Anyway, I've lost it in my notes, but that's so that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thanks a lot, Vivek. I think that'll get us thinking. So could I ask the two guests from the office to come and join?
Just a few more technical questions already, and then I'll switch over to the IDS. And I'll be inviting some of the other countries to improve their statistical measures. follow an interesting statistic on government expenditures, for example. I just wonder, where do you get those numbers?
Sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Where do we get the data on government expenditure?
It's a statistics, but
I'm sorry. Let me try that again. So I work in statistics, and I've been working helping some of these Pacific Island countries improve their statistics, their national accounts, and so on. And I know that there's a big difficulty, and they need a lot of improvement. I was interested in your statistics, and for example, you showed some nice charts on government expenditures. The question I have is, where do you get those statistics, and how confident are you in those statistics?
Should I answer one by one, or later? How do you want me to handle this?
If you just go ahead and answer.
So this, the data that we show here are data that we collect during our missions to countries. The database on the Pacific Islands is more challenging than others, but during our what we call Article 4 missions, it's basically a yearly trip that we have to these countries to discuss the health of their economic situation. We always have an update from the authorities on data. I mean, it's actually part of the requirement of the membership that they give us this data, because without data, it's not possible to make any assessment. So that's what we do, and we share the data. This data is, some of the data is on the World Economic Outlook database, and for the Pacific Islands, we basically share the data once we publish things. So it's not.
Look, I have one follow-up. Just be very quick. I ask the question mostly because I know that most of these small countries don't measure GDP on an expenditure basis. So, for example, government expenditures and other types of expenditures really just aren't available in most of those countries, to the best of my knowledge.
Right. There are some countries that do it, but not much. But the way we use the current expenditures, because we have the budget. So by having the budget, you can see what is the part of current and also the development budget, which is a little bit more challenging. So we get the data on current and government expenditure, not from the GDP accounts, but from the budget accounts. But that's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Ron.
Ron Duncan, Crawford. Just picking up on your early points and linking it to what Vivette said about very small private sectors, mm-hmm. So limited tax revenue. You talked about financial deepening is very, very poor.
Right.
And in my belief, that's because they don't have land as a clap that they can use for clap for borrowing. A country only has a mature financial system if it has land, if it can securitize land.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the Pacific, it's very rare to securitize land. So maybe, that, to my mind, that explains the very small private sector to a large extent. But I'm just wondering whether it also explains the geography. Like, Vivek's first slide he put up, that difference which he has moved to geography, it may be that, it's because the Pacific Island countries can't collateralize land, and therefore people basically can't borrow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with you on this issue that land tenure and communal land is definitely a constraint in terms of collateral. And perhaps the exception is Palau, where from some historical reason has solved this problem of land tenure a little bit earlier. We're not expert about land issues, but we know that has a big impact in the Pacific, and it's also a very sensitive issue. So it's really hard to engage the authorities. I would say also for the World Bank, you have more expertise than I am.
Different from other.
Well, we have. That's a very good question, and we have been trying to look on other regions and not necessarily islands, but you can still have the same thing. And lately we come across, we just started looking into that, so I don't have a good answer to this question, but we start looking at the situation in Peru, and it looks like Peru, for some reason, is very similar to the situation in the Pacific Islands, and we're trying to figure it out, what is the parallel. It's not in terms of, we shouldn't necessarily compare the small states across themselves, but more about what are the thematics, the issues, and so we should looking into this
let me just more. Jump in on that as well. I'm going to say my background is more on the African side than Pacific Islands, but I was resident in Uganda for a couple of years, and quite early on I was convinced that land tenure issues was part of the development process. You don't have the same degree of communal land ownership in Africa, but you do have sort of still tribal traditions where the chief within a village has the right to block a land transaction, and you only hold land under the goodwill of the chief, etc. And I felt that was holding back private credit in the banking system. But over the past 10 years, you've seen a very rapid increase in financial intermediation in a number of African countries, and it's not because things have moved forwards on the land tenure side and the land registration systems. Those are still mired in the past, and I think it may be as much to do with the credit environment. You know, if you don't have things moving in the economy, good investment opportunities, then people aren't going to lend regardless of what the land tenure system is. So you may be able to make movement in terms of sort of liberalisation of the economy, and that could encourage credit even if the land tenure is still blocked. I mean, for example, salary-based credits, you know, people who've got good tenured positions in the formal sector, the banks will give you credit based on the right to claim money back out of your salary. So that's one option without having the land-based collateral.
Okay, Margaret.
Thanks, Margaret Callum, Development Policy Centre. I have a question which I'd be interested in perspective of both from the World Bank and the IMF. So it relates to the chart, Patricia, that you put up towards the end on higher capital expenditure equals higher growth, lower capital expenditure equals lower growth. I'm not sure whether that's as a policy recommendation or an observation, but I have a lot of difficulty with that connection for a couple of reasons. One, the phenomenon of building neglect that's very widespread in the Pacific. The other is the point you made about the quality of government spending. What's the point of building something? The quality of government spending is very poor. And, I mean, just examples of when there's, in Papua New Guinea, when there's been road infrastructure, investment in road infrastructure, unless that's followed up by maintenance, right, which persists for a good number of years, you will not get a growth response because the farmers seem to want to see, we won't invest too much until we see the road's going to be maintained. If it's maintained for longer, then we might expand outward. So I'm not too sure whether, you know, how you see this working in the Pacific, or whether that was an observation more generally of the world. But I think there were comments on that.
Sure.
Do you want
to start?
Sure. No, I think that's a great question. Good to see you here, Margaret. What you defined as build and neglect, I would sort of, you know, call it, take it a next step, which is, you know, build, neglect, and rebuild is what happens in the Pacific, and most of that is done through donor expenditure. And actually, so, I mean, maintenance is critical, I mean, for sure. We have enough studies that show that, you know, it is cheaper to maintain infrastructure rather than to rebuild it. But how does all this, I think your question was more about, well, that's a well-known fact, how does this all link up with growth? Let me break it up in two ways. One is, you know, first looking at how is this capital expenditure financed in most Pacific countries, I mean, depending on period. And I would argue that a lot of this, I would say, I mean, three-quarters of it is financed through external assistance, both grants and loans. Now, again, given that a large infrastructure project in a small country is a fairly hefty game in town, that itself, the act of doing that, increases GDP growth rate in the short run and potentially also in the longer term. So what you're observing, I mean, what I would say, what you're observing is much needed capital expenditure financed by external sources leading to growth, or being two sides of the same coin, if you will, you know, showing up as growth in the national accounts. And I mean, you know, I can give you many examples. I mean, Kiribati is a current example. Right now, the growth you observed there 3 years ago and 4 years in Tuvalu, which was all government sort of donor-funded capital expenditure. But coming back quickly to this issue of maintenance, and I think why there is neglect is because the donor finance, the donor who's financing this capital expenditure assumes that because this is such a good asset for the country, that the government would somehow find resources to maintain that. I mean, and this doesn't happen in the Pacific. It happens anywhere in the world that, you know, maintenance expenditures play second fiddle to wage increases, or, you know, sort of teachers who are protesting paying their salaries. So what is the solution? The solution here is for the donor to be a little bit rational. You know, if they're going to rebuild this infrastructure in the future, why do they not upfront agree to financing maintenance? Of course, you have to have incentive compatible contracts, but it is possible. And so my answer there would be that, you know, don't only build it, agree to maintain it over a very long term. Thanks. Sorry, long answer.
No, I mean, you were asking whether this is a policy recommendation or just the descriptions of the data. It is a little bit both, with the strong caveat that I put at the analysis, which is really the quality of spending that matters. And having said that, I don't want to repeat myself, I also think that given that the public sector will have to continue to play a big role in the Pacific, at least in some of them that are more scattered, we really think that the investment in infrastructure, and I'm thinking about physical infrastructure, but also human capital infrastructure, is really very important. The rate of return of the investment itself depends on the human capital, so it's quite of a complicated issue. But the ability of the government to crowd in the private sector will have to be there, so we can't just give it up by saying that they are remote, which is obvious, but at the same time, it's important to remember we have to, you know, discuss with the authorities what is the way forward. And we think that the way forward is to look at their spending mix a little bit more carefully, and it's a big discussion that we need to have also with the development partners, including ourselves, and the type of assistance we give to these countries. But going back to the issue about remoteness and geography. And this is actually more of a World Bank, so I'm stepping in your toes. And the reason why I think that connectivity matters is not because geography doesn't play a role, but think about the importance of internet. I mean, are you closer or further if you have internet access? It's as simple as this. So the first time I went to Kiribati, there was no internet access in the place where I was staying. And this has changed through times. And I think that because of that, the island is closer now. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have the 3,400 kilometers from Tarawa to Christmas Island. That distance is going to be there forever. But if you are more connected, then you can be more connected and have access to services, not just, and even financial services, not just through credit, but you can have it through financial inclusion, through mobile phone and things like that. And you are more connected, even if you are really in the middle of, you know, an island in the Pacific. So geography is a constraint, but what I was trying to say is that there is some hope, to the extent that we recognize these constraints and we try to see where the strategic you know, policies that can be implemented as well.
Just a quick. I completely agree. I think the point I was trying to make, and I don't think I made it very clearly, was that will connectivity lead to growth in the Pacific? And I don't know. I'm not sure it will. But what it will certainly do is lead to better public service delivery. and therefore connectivity is very important in the Pacific, but someone has to pay for it, and governments do not have sufficient revenues to pay for it. The Kiribati example, again, I think it's great.
Well,
it's who's paying for it is
right,
the question.
Right, but I mean Kiribati, and we forgot about this, and the countries that you're saying they are growing less than the others, and we're Tuvalu, Kiribati, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, but especially Tuvalu and Kiribati, they have this big wealth, which is the fish, but they just can't tap this resource. I mean, and this is, again, it's a complicated issue, but they're not poor countries in the way we would define a country, right? They have a huge untapped resource and the largest marine resource in the world. So why are we characterizing these countries as poor without resource? They do have resource, and they need to have some schemes that help to manage them, and I think that the bank has helped them out on this one. So that's another thing to it, some food for thoughts.
Okay, we've got quite a few questions now. So Ian, in the back, I'll take a couple.
Thank you very much for those very good presentations. I wonder if you could just comment about population, but it's extremely good sort of structural. What seems to strike me is that most of those countries in the Pacific have quite high levels of population growth, with lots of extra pressures on government expenditure, schools, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me that in Melanesia there's high levels of then youth unemployment, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But in Polynesia, the people who are at that sort of working age, they go to New Zealand or Australia if they can, and that also has its own sort of social and economic problems in the sense that you're getting societies which are either very young or very old.
Mm-hmm.
And I see some anecdotal evidence that the remittances that they get coming back into Polynesia are spent on consumer items which are often imported, or going into building yet another church. So you kind of wonder, is this really a viable sort of system when your populations are growing? What advice can you give on that? What else should we know?
It's a very secular question here. I'll take a few because we're going to run out of time. So yeah, please.
I have to put my position forward as a pro-geographical focus on this. I think connectivity is important, but when I think about a place like the Marshall Islands, which in my view is one of the most remote places, and it has a whole lot of issues of, you know, sea level rises and all sorts of things, access to markets would be absolutely hugely significant in its economic activity. And even a place like the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, the issue of trying to get something across a whole lot of range of island states or very mountainous terrain is a huge problem. I wonder if in the assessments that are made by the World Bank or the IMF, that those sorts of factors could be taken into account, which for the Caribbean or other places, they're right next to the biggest markets in the world, and that's one of the great advantages. And also about flexibility of infrastructure, I'm aware also, picking up Ian's point, that in the Cook Islands, which has a very strong relationship with New Zealand, one of the innovative ways there of health service, and a lot of the working age people, adults for education work, go to New Zealand, so they have a large older and very young population living in those places. It's often seen as cheaper and better efficiencies to helicopter people out for medical services from remote places into the capital city for services and provide educational or childcare facilities for grandparents who are responsible for looking after their grandchildren. It's that contextual sort of stuff about innovation. So would the IMF and the World Bank take into account not just access to market, but when you get in the country, how you access services within that country as a determinant of economic growth?
Mm-hmm. All right, so it's quite a lot there. I think we'll take those two and come back. No, just hold on to your question. We'll let the panel respond.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead?
Sure, yeah. No, I think population growth, obviously, I mean, it is a problem, especially in Melanesia, not so much in Polynesia or Micronesia. So what to do about populations is a long-term question. I mean, I think that's one area of focus. I think the other point that you made was on remittances and, you know, how they are being used. Again, what I would argue is, I mean, again, not kind of conjecturing how these will pan out over the medium term or long term, you know, whether they'll increase or decrease. It is how can remittances be channeled into improving human capital outcomes, bettering education, health outcomes. So, which is a little bit different from, you know, sort of channeling all these remittances somewhere or another into capital investments, which will generate growth. Again, because I think growth is going to be constrained by geography, you're not going to get much out of growth, but I think you'll get a lot more out of using remittance flows to build human capital. And I think on your point, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, it's really, it's access to those services that matters. And in fact, that is a big focus of our project work in most of the countries.
On the question of population, I mean, it's as you said, it's more of a secular thing. But what we're trying to do in our analysis, and what we're trying to do early on, is really to think about growth, but in per capita terms, because otherwise it would be really misleading, given that population growth, for example, is very high in Papua New Guinea. It is a challenge, and this high level of population are not common in other countries. Now, one thing I want to say, and it's a new work that the IMF has done, and it's not related to the Pacific Islands, but has, I think, could be quite relevant, is about women participation to labor force. So it's true that in the Pacific Islands, the population growth is quite high. But women participation in labor force is not, for several reasons. And a recent IMF work, the first one was actually based on Japan, where women participation is quite low, shows that the gains from, in terms of development, not necessarily growth, are quite high if this is going to happen. So there is even a more, you know, broader question about population, which is more gender balance. This was not really the core of our IMF work, but has become more important, and we think also that perhaps we can look at this issue more in the Pacific too. It's quite important. On the question of the challenges of the Pacific Islands, actually here, Peter is the guru, and we started with this board paper last March to raise awareness within the executive board of the IMF. Now, we talk about this issue here, about geography and how important it is, but I just want to let you know that these problems are not very well known outside the region, that you know, in the past people were thinking that most states were facing the same issues, where scale issue about size, it's not just size, it's being really very scattered. So I would say that Peter's work was really to raise this awareness within, you know, the fund and more the international community, and you are taking the leadership in writing this guidance note and see how we can, you know.
Yeah. So there's a lot of work still ongoing in the United Nations. There's a conference in Samoa next autumn, which is the next big step in their work on small states, and they've got a work program leading up to that. Mm-hmm. So they want to work closely with the IMF in the run-up to that, so we'll be doing various things.
But basically we're trying to tailor our policy advice to the needs of the small states, and we have to recognize these challenges when we look at, you know, budget deficit, the fact that it's a deficit bias just because of how these islands are allocated. And it's not, I would say that it's not strange that Palau, that is much more concentrated, is relatively easier to access, is actually a middle-income country that is very much comparable with the Caribbean, while some other islands are not. But I still think that, you know, that perhaps I'm a little bit more optimistic than you. You've been in the region for too long. I still think that we need to discuss with the authorities and the development partners and find a Pacific way, which is not necessarily, you know, the same advice we would give to other countries, but we need to find a Pacific way to move forward.
Okay, we are running out of time, so I think this is the last question.
My question is very broad. Sorry, my name is Sylvain Kalsakal. I am from the College of Asia Pacific, the EMU. Now, many Pacific Island countries have attained political independence, and unfortunately, the same cannot be said about their economy. slavery Pacific Island countries continue to depend on foreign aid. From the World Bank and IMF's perspective, how effective has foreign aid been in the Pacific Islands in terms of aiding development of Pacific Island economies?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, you know, fair assessment is it has had a mixed record. But I think, you know, there's been a tendency to measure the success of aid by looking at growth rates. And I think the point is that perhaps growth is not really the best metric to judge, you know, the effectiveness of aid. If you look at, you know, infant mortality rates, life expectancy, you know, maternal mortality, all these indicators have shown a lot of progress, you know, in the last four decades. Now, of course, you know, if you say, is this because of aid? Well, you know, aid's been, it's, maybe you can say it's happened in spite of aid, but I take the view that it is because of aid. That, you know, and it's not really, you know, that you put the money on the table and it's going to happen. Aid is effective when the government, and I know it's a much used term, when the government shows ownership of the policies that it wants to implement. And I think we see a bit of that in the health and education sectors where we've seen the good outcomes.
No, I share Vivek's views about the fact that sometimes the record has been mixed, and but nevertheless there's been improvement in the development indicators. I have to say that this improvement has happened from a very low base, but has been there. As you know, the involvement of the IMF and is together with the World Bank, Australia, the ADB, Asia, and we provide a lot of aid in terms of technical assistance and training. And this is sort of a successful story because. I mean, we have been seeing through the years that the demand for this technical assistance and training has increased through time, and we were able to see from some development that has been quite effective. I mean, it's spotty, it's not the same across the islands, but definitely I would say that the capacity building is a successful story. But it's very hard to assess the effectiveness of aid in general. There is no counterfactual. I mean, So it's quite a question. It's a very important question, but I don't have a good answer.
Okay. Well, look, we are out of time. We're going to have to wrap it up. I think it's been a very useful session. I think this debate between, on the one hand, the kind of standard economic prescriptions that we know apply to all economies versus the unique circumstance of the Pacific, I think that tension will continue to preoccupy us. And this has been a very useful contribution to helping us resolve some of those debates. So if you could please join me in thanking...
Been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.